thank you for listening to another Hastings NAS podcast. We are so pleased that you have shown interest in listening to this podcast, and we pray that it is edifying and beneficial for you. You can watch us live every Sunday morning on Facebook, facebook.com/HastingsNAS. And if you are so inclined, you can support the ministries of the church by going to hastingsnas.org/give. Hope you enjoy this sermon. Grace and peace. Church, may I invite you to stand for the gospel reading, which is Matthew chapter 17. The gospel reading is the story of the transfiguration, and I've taken the liberty of adding a little section, verses 14 through 20a, of what happens immediately following that mountain moment. Listen to these words. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make 3 dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from a cloud said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Verse 14, when they came to the crowd, a man came to him, knelt before him, and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Jesus answered, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was cured instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the world. Amen. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Before I get into the message, I just want to encourage you to participate in the way through our Lenten resource and series. This is a spiritual guide that I think will be very beneficial for all of us as we participate together. And then also, 40 days of prayer during Lent, we're inviting the whole church to a season of prayer. And I would encourage you to sign up on the form in the foyer for a specific day, for a specific slot, and kind of shift the balance of staff signups with congregation signups, all right? There's a lot there. Last report I had was there was a lot of staff signed up, but we need a little bit more of your support. Okay, I'm putting off preaching this message long enough. Because when I tell you I did not want to write this sermon, you've got to believe me. There are some sermons that pastors preach that they would rather not preach, and if I'm being honest, that was today. And I put off writing it as long as I possibly could. Which is strange because it's transfiguration. This is the transfiguration of Jesus. This is a great day. I love the transfiguration. I love to reflect on it. It's one of those special Sundays that you celebrate every year. Every year the Sunday before Ash Wednesday is the transfiguration of Jesus. The season of the church year called the season after the Epiphany is bookended by two, here's a great word for you, church. This is a $5 word, theophanies. It's a great word, theophanies. A theophany is a divine epiphany. Theo being the Greek word for God. It's a divine epiphany. It is a revelation of God. The first Sunday after the Epiphany, we celebrate the baptism of Jesus. In that moment, the heavens opened up, a dove descended, and the voice of God spoke, saying, "This is my son, my beloved. With him I am well pleased." And then today we read the last Sunday after the Epiphany, not that the heavens opened, but that instead Jesus took some disciples up to the heavens. And who joined him but the author of the law and the great prophets, Moses and Elijah? And once again, the voice of God spoke, saying, "This is my son, my beloved. Listen to him." I mean, this is a great text. This is a great story. This is divine revelation. This is revival. I mean, what does Peter say? Peter says, "Oh, Jesus, it is good. It is good that we are here. Let's build some tents so we can hang out here for a while." Have you ever had those moments? Have you ever experienced a movement of the Spirit that so saturated a room that you didn't want to leave that space? You just wanted to put a little tent up and camp there. You just want to dwell in that holy, sacred, saturated space. Maybe it was at a retreat or a camp. You know what I'm talking about? Chances are, at this point, you've heard about the revival that's taking place at Asbury University down in Kentucky. They're calling it an outpouring. On site, they don't call it a revival. They call it an outpouring. And it started 2 Wednesdays ago. If you haven't been following, it started on Wednesday, not last Wednesday, but the Wednesday before last Wednesday, on a normal chapel service in the middle of the week. And the school has not stopped worshiping since. 24/7 for 10 days or more. It is apparently a thing to behold. The reports I've read have been that the outpouring has been filled with confession, with reconciliation, with healing, particularly for those who've been sexually abused, and transformation. And the reports I've read is that there is a sweet stillness about that space. Kind of an unstructured order, an unplanned order about it, and that this is a thin space. A space where the veil between heaven and earth is so thin, you can almost peer through it. This outpouring from a distance looks like a beautifully fresh outpouring of the Spirit. I am celebrating what God is doing in Kentucky through those college students. I love preaching the Transfiguration because it is one of those truly mountaintop moments. One of those spaces where the presence of God is just undeniable. One of those moments that can't be manufactured or manipulated. So why was it so hard to get this message written? And why is it something I've tried to avoid preaching? Well, because early on in the week, I didn't stop reading at verse 9, which was the assigned text for the day by the lectionary. I often do this, but this week, maybe by mistake, I just kept reading. The assigned text was Matthew 17, 1 through 9. And I went to verse 10. And then 11 and 12 to 20. And it was as if the Lord said to me, "The lectionary was made for man, not man for the lectionary." That is, you are not bound by the chapter and verse numbers assigned to you by the lectionary, pastor. And I said, "What are you saying, God?" And he said, "I'm saying maybe you should keep preaching." So I kept reading another 10 verses, and what stood out to me was the juxtaposition of Jesus on the mountain with Jesus in the crowd. Did you catch that this morning? Was anybody else whiplashed by that? Right after Jesus comes down from the mountain with Peter, James, and John, what does he do? What does he say? Jesus is confronted with a child who suffers from epilepsy. A man brings his suffering child with a brain disorder, with this mental illness, who is not getting the care that he needs. And Jesus is seemingly not filled with compassion in this moment, church. No, Jesus is filled with disgust, even anger, indignation. You go from this moment where the Spirit descends in a cloud and Moses and Elijah are present, and the voice of God speaks in such a way that the disciples tremble and fall to the ground in fear. This undeniable presence of God. And then Jesus comes down from the mountain, and what does he say to the people, to his disciples, but, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer do I have to be with you? How much longer must I put up with you?" Whew. You faithless generation. I don't like to think about that Jesus. I like to think about the Jesus on the mountain who has compassion on his disciples and touches them, not the one who calls us faithless. "This is my son. I love him so much." Turns so quickly into, "How much longer do I have to be with you?" Jesus says that his own disciples are faithless. "Jesus, why couldn't we drive out this one? Why couldn't we do it?" Jesus says, "Well, because you didn't have faith. Because you didn't have faith." Now, let me qualify this a little bit. You see, this faithlessness is not merely that the disciples didn't believe enough, okay? When we talk about faith in the New Testament, we need to stop thinking that faith is a mental agreement to a propositional truth. What I mean by that is faith in the New Testament is not saying, "Yes, I can understand and comprehend the existence of a divine being and that the divine being became incarnate and became flesh and died for my sins. I can agree with that mentally." That's not faith in the New Testament. Faith is much more embodied. It's much more inhabited. It's much more practiced. Jesus calls them, maybe another word for faithless is incredulous. You are incredulous. You can't even like see what's right in front of you. Here's the thing though. They were trying to do the right thing. Those disciples were trying to do the right thing. They said, "Jesus, we tried to heal this boy. We tried to help him out." They were trying to do the right thing, trying to heal this epileptic child. To understand what this faithlessness looks like, to illustrate faithlessness, maybe we need to look to another mountaintop moment. A moment that we can maybe use today that can be recognizable to us, because this is a moment where this person was also with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. That moment is, of course, what we read earlier this morning, the story of Moses on the mountain. We read from Exodus 24 earlier this morning, the story when God gave Moses the Ten Commandments. And when Moses was on that mountain, the Spirit of God was as bright as the sun. Like the transfiguration of Jesus, a cloud covered the mountain. The voice of God spoke. And if you remember, when Moses came down from the mountain, he had to cover his face. He had to put a veil over himself. Why? Because his face was glowing with the reflection of God. I like to think that in this moment, time and space were condensed into one eternal moment. In Greek, we would call this a kairos moment. That despite living generations apart, and despite being miles apart geographically, that time and space were brought together on the Mount of Transfiguration. And that in that moment, Moses' face was glowing because he was reflecting the image of God that he witnessed in the Word of God. So we read this mountaintop moment with Moses, but I didn't keep reading in Exodus. Kayla didn't keep reading in Exodus. We read Exodus 24, but if you skip ahead 8 chapters, do you know what happens in Exodus 32? Bible quiz. You know what happens in Exodus 32? God's anger is kindled against Israel. Why? Well, because they all took off their jewelry. I'm getting a little bigger. They took off their rings, their necklaces, their earrings. They brought them together, and they cast them into a calf, into a young bull, a golden calf. And so when Moses descends from the mountain to find the Israelites dancing around a golden calf, reveling is what the Old Testament says. There was revelry. He is so angry. What does he do but break the tablets of stone, destroying the commandments of God before them? What if I told you today that, like those disciples a few thousand years later, those Israelites were just trying to do the right thing? Just maybe in the wrong way. Because you see, when Israel left Egypt, we read in the Exodus story that the Israelites plundered Egypt on their way out. They took with them gold and jewelry, all the bounty of Egypt. They brought with them everything they could get their hands on. And so when they create this golden calf, this was them fighting their own culture war. They were saying, we need to get rid of Egypt. Look at us, we're all adorned with this Egyptian gold and beauty. Maybe God has taken Moses from us for 40 days and 40 nights because we still look like we're from Egypt. This is like a 4,000-year-old youth pastor holding a cassette tape burning, okay? You're going to burn all the tapes because we look too much like the secular world around us. The Israelites were just trying to purify themselves of Egypt. They were fighting their culture war, and they thought they were winning by ridding themselves of this cultural influence. But in reality, they weren't purifying themselves of anything. They weren't purifying themselves of anything. They were putting their trust in the wrong things. They were practicing idolatry, unfaithfulness. One of my favorite ways to translate this is infidelity. There was infidelity from the people to Yahweh. That's unfaithfulness. And they were trusting not in the God who brought them up out of Egypt. They were instead trusting in their own ability to fight their wars how they want, this culture war at that time. So if you want to know what Jesus means when he calls the crowd a faithless generation, when he tells the disciples that they have no faith, that they are incredulous, look to the Israelites and Moses. Because Moses was there with Jesus on the mountain too, you know. Faithlessness is idolatry. Faithlessness is infidelity. It's not simply not agreeing about something with your mind. Faithlessness is putting wrong things in the wrong place. It is placing allegiances above Christ and Christ's kingdom. Here with Moses and the Israelites, there is again this juxtaposition of the glory of God over against the infidelity of the people. The same juxtaposition that was with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration is with Moses on Mount Sinai. Jesus on the Mount with Peter, James, and John hearing the voice of God compared to him saying, you faithless and perverse generation. Moses on Mount Sinai hearing the voice of God compared with God saying, this people have acted perversely and have abandoned me. There's a juxtaposition. They don't fit together. I don't know about you, but I think we too have a juxtaposition of our own in our world today. And it's the title of the sermon, A Tale of Two Campuses. I've already mentioned one of them, the outpouring of 2023 at Asbury University, a university and a sister denomination, the United Methodist Church. I have many friends who went to seminary there, actually. And it seems apparent that the glory of God is on the move in that place. And we celebrate that. I think we can say with Peter, it is good. It is good. But then the other campus, that's not in a sister denomination, that's in a sister city. Just down the road. If you're like Kayla and I, last week we could not turn off the TV. We could not stop refreshing our feeds to get as much information we could about another school shooting, this one at Michigan State. You feel the juxtaposition here? How do we go from students shouting out to Jesus on one campus to students shouting for fear of their life on another? I'm struck that when Jesus came down from the mountain with those disciples, it was a parent who brought his suffering child to Christ, because neither the crowd nor the disciples could do anything to make him well and release him from the demonic. Church, we will be sending our oldest child to preschool this year. And you're kidding yourself if you think Kayla and I haven't talked about how we're going to talk to her about school shootings. You're kidding yourself if you think that we're not scared to death about what it means to put our kid in a school in the 21st century. We have those dreadful conversations about what on earth we would do if our daughter was taken from us because someone came into her school and shot it up. From Sandy Hook to Michigan State, it seems like as a society, as the crowd, we are functionally okay with this. We say we're not. We say we're not. Where's the fruit? Are we a clanging gong and a resounding cymbal? Where we say the things that need to be said and then nothing changes? Church, last week, a man with a prior gun conviction, a man with some serious emotional concerns that were known to people close to him, a man who was almost completely isolated from everyone else around him, was allowed to legally purchase multiple firearms, dozens of rounds of ammunition, without registering them. And that blows my mind. I registered my child. I registered my car, and I got insurance from my car, and I have to show proof of registration and proof of insurance before I can take it home. I'm no expert in all of this, and I'm not going to pretend to be. But it seems to me from a theological, from a pastoral perspective, that we have a perfect storm leading to these continuous and nonstop tragedies that are traumatizing our kids. You know, there were multiple students on campus at Michigan State who had lived through prior school shootings. This is the first time in American history where students have survived multiple shootings. I don't pretend to be an expert, but it seems to me that we have the perfect storm to traumatize our kids. We have the perfect storm of unparalleled and apparently unqualified access to tools that were created to maim, harm, and kill, whether in defense or offense. We have inaccessible, unaffordable, and culturally shamed access to emotional and mental care. And maybe most of all, we have perpetually lonely people. What a faithless and perverse generation we are that we allow our children to continue to suffer the violence of school shootings. And if there's a faithlessness about our generation that leads to this perfect storm, maybe it is this, that we are unwilling to take ourselves off of the thrones of our own hearts. Listen to this. If there is a perversity about our generation, maybe it is this, that we put ourselves first. That we put ourselves above others, and that I can't be bothered to change myself. If there is idolatry, it is the idolatry of the self. It is a self-centeredness to put our own preferences and our own privileges and our own rights first and to put aside anything that might hinder them. I'm telling you, that's not the way of the cross. It is a self-centeredness to imagine broken brains and broken hearts are any different than a broken arm or a broken toe. It is a self-centeredness to make emotional and mental care completely inaccessible to those who need it most. It is a self-centeredness to let people languish in their isolation. The Michigan State shooter wasn't the only person who had no friends, who had no community. It was known. Who knows what could have changed if after his mother died, which his father reported was when everything shifted in him. When his mother died, when he was grieving the loss of his mother, who knows what could have changed if after that grief there was a faith community that surrounded him and supported him. There are people who said, I know, I've lost my mother too. This sucks. I'm with you. What a faithless and perverse generation we are that we allow our children to continue to suffer the violence of school shootings because we aren't willing to effect the necessary changes to protect those who bear the image of God. This is the tale of two campuses. The shouts of students in praise to God for his manifest presence. And the shouts of students in anguish to God because of our manifest unfaithfulness. Lord, have mercy on us. If there is any good news in this today, the good news is here. The good news is at the table. The good news is that despite our unfaithfulness, there is one who has been forever faithful. That there is one who took capital punishment, who took weapons created for torture and death and used them to bring life. If there's good news, it is that God is faithful.